Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Susanna Fox of the Pew Research Center Internet and American Life Project. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare reports on a program at Dartmouth designed to enhance the security of mobile health data. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Barry Katz's wife was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, it began a four-year odyssey of treatments, of illness, ultimately her passing. With two daughters to raise and a business to run, Barry found the role of caregiver all the more challenging as his wife became sicker. He was preparing for a daughter's bat mitzvah and a business launch when he learned that his wife's battle was nearing the end. In desperation, he reached out to family for help, and it arrived instantly. He decided he would use his family's experience to launch a new business venture, one that would help other families going through what he had get the help they needed. His idea? LotsOfHelpingHands.com, an online platform that brings communities together to help caregivers dealing with loved ones in a crisis. What Barry found was you can be overwhelmed with offers for help, or not have enough people reaching out to help when you really need it, or not having people who knew what to do. Whether it's a family caring for a special needs child, a parent with Alzheimer's, or a wounded veteran, Lots of Helping Hands allows caregivers to set up an online community of volunteers who can do everything from helping provide family meals to taking a patient to treatment to making sure a child gets picked up at school. Since founding Lots of Helping Hands 5 years ago, 750,000 volunteers have helped 25,000 people around the world get the caregiver support they need. Families set up online communities with calendars and volunteers pledge online for a specific task. Barry's design of the site was intended to ensure several things: that it would always be free to those who use it, that it would be an intuitive site to navigate, easy for all to use, that it was private and secure, and that it provided a robust platform for feedback. The tens of thousands of testimonials speak volumes about its success, with most saying, essentially, that in the most troubling time of need, Lots of Helping Hands helped make the unbearable bearable. An online portal that brings volunteers who want to help together with caregivers who desperately need their help. Now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with Susanna Fox, Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization which studies the social impact of the Internet. Ms. Fox is a leading analyst at the intersection between technology and healthcare and has been charting the growth of social network and health information sharing for a dozen years. She's a regular contributor to ePatients.net and was an editor at U.S. News and World Report. Susanna, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
You know, you've been analyzing and compiling data on a steady growth of the internet and its intersection with healthcare, especially with mobile phone technology, for the past dozen years, but you've focused on the specific area, the social life of health information, and your research has shown that with wireless technology, we as a culture have started to see information as portable, personalized, and participatory. Let our listeners know what you mean by the social life of health information and connect the dots of why it's so important to understand this if we want to see patients achieve better health outcomes with the help of the internet.
When we started our research back in the year 2000, only about half of American adults had access to the internet. Only 5% had broadband. And the internet was really seen back then as a slow, stationary information vending machine. You went up to it, you asked a question, and it gave you back the beginnings of an answer. What we see now with the rise of smartphones and broadband is that people expect to get so much more from the internet, and they expect to be able to have the answers right in their pocket or in their purse. And that changes our relationship with information, so that people now not only have access to information, but they have access to each other. And in healthcare, that means that there is always access to somebody who is just ahead of you on a treatment path. Someone who maybe just had a baby and can tell you about how it went, or who just had that surgery that your mother is considering and can tell you about the recovery time. What we see in our research is that 1 in 5 internet users say they have looked online for someone like them, and that increases if we just focus on people who are living with a chronic disease. 1 in 4 internet users living with a chronic condition say they have looked online for someone like me. So the social life of health information is in this sharing that's going on, that's available night and day, wherever you are.
So, Susanna, it seems safe to say that in these past dozen years or so, there's been an online healthcare revolution. So here we are, it's 2012. People are accessing health information online. Mobile technologies are going to move us even further in this arena. What's your thoughts on how this impacts how people will actually access healthcare?
So you mentioned the word revolution, and I need to talk a little bit about the 3 revolutions that we've actually seen now. The first revolution was broadband, and I mentioned that back in the year 2000, only 5% of American households had it. Now we're up to 2/3. The second revolution was the mobile revolution. We're now up to 88% of American adults who have a cell phone. Half of those are smartphones, which can access the internet. And the third revolution is social networking. We're now up to 2/3 of internet users who are now using social networking sites like Facebook and LinkedIn. And older adults are actually the fastest growing group. What this means for healthcare is that, again, people are expecting to have access to information and to each other and to services anytime, wherever they are. And that means that people are starting to look at what kinds of services they can get online that might make their lives easier. And so healthcare service providers would do well to look at other industries that have been disrupted already, such as banking and travel, and even the news business. Because that's what we've seen over the last decade here at the Pew Research Center, that as those industries have been forced to change, they have been forced to take into account these 3 revolutions of broadband, mobile, and social. And so those are the areas that I'm looking at in terms of healthcare delivery. How can healthcare delivery take advantage, not just be blindsided, but really take advantage of the revolutions that have changed the information and communications landscape?
I want to pull the thread on your earlier statement that 1 out of 5 of the people who were searching the internet were looking for someone like them or someone like me. And we've had a couple of health information pioneers on our show who've been developing services, it seems to me, for patients who are out there looking. We've had e-patient Dave DeBroncart, who fought for the right to gain access to his own medical records and launched a movement. And Jamie Haywood, founder of the data sharing site Patients Like Me, where folks suffering from a variety of diseases publicly share their medical experiences in open forum. So tell us more about these e-patient trends you've been studying at Pew, and how are they impacting the medical community and healthcare in general in the country?
Great question. Just as we saw broadband go from a tiny fraction of the population to now 2/3 of American households, we're seeing the same thing, the beginning of a trend where there's always been a small group of patients who were willing to dig in, who asked for their medical records, maybe they didn't receive them, who wanted to get involved in the research to help save their own lives or the lives of their loved ones. And for many, many years, they did not have access to the tools that could really help them to contribute, and now they do. What we're seeing now is that sites like Patients Like Me are giving powerful tools to the people with the most at stake, patients and the people who love them. And what I've seen in my research is that you really don't want to stand in between the mother of a child with a rare condition, and information that will save that child's life. And the internet can be a secret weapon in that battle or in that long, long journey, even just to get to a diagnosis. And what I've also seen in our research is that the internet can just continue and amplify the behaviors that all of us do anyway. It's very human to want to share what's going on in our lives and to compare notes with a neighbor or someone who's going through the same thing. And what the internet allows us to do is to broaden our neighborhood to include the whole world so that anyone who feels rare and alone in their diagnosis doesn't have to be anymore. They can find someone like them. And patients like me gives people the tools to not only find each other, but patients like me allows people to track, to measure, and compare across this wider neighborhood so that they can go toe-to-toe with scientists and with clinicians and say, what I have here is my daily log of symptoms and how this particular drug is affecting me and 100 other people who have my same condition.
Well, Suzanne, I want to pick up on that trend of self-tracking that you're describing, not just for the rare and most unusual conditions, but really people are using their phone and internet apps to track everything from their calorie intake to glucose levels, exercise activity, keeping up their medications, even tracking their moods as they manage various chronic illnesses. And I understand you're keynoting an event on this topic on what the future looks like for self-tracking. So with all the innovation, the thousands of apps available, but still no one platform to easily interface between patients and their healthcare providers, what's your sense of how this tracking ultimately is affecting people's health? What trends are you forecasting in this area of self-tracking? And I always ask that other question, are you sure anybody's home on the other side in terms of the provider offices with being able to have the time and the attention and the tools to make use of that data in a meaningful way?
Well, you've put your finger on a perennial issue with the internet and technology and healthcare, and that is we continually see two silos growing up in parallel. And one is on the patient side, where patients are starting to have access to these powerful tools of self-tracking and networking within their own communities. And on the other side, we have this push towards electronic medical records. But again, it's very rare to see the two silos connect.
We're speaking today with Susanna Fox, Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Internet and the American Life Project, funded by the Pew Charitable Trust. She's been analyzing trends at the intersection of technology and healthcare for over a dozen years. Now, Susanna, you focused quite a bit on research on another way people are utilizing the internet in healthcare, and that's tracking patient safety issues. Tell us about your findings that you were able to share on the potential social media has in the area of patient safety.
Our research indicates that many people are looking for ways to educate themselves about issues like what can they expect as they go into a new diagnosis or a new treatment. What we find is that 80% of internet users are doing this type of research online. 20% are contributing reviews, reviews about hospitals, about doctors, about certain drugs. And they're also posting their own personal stories about what happened to them when they went through a treatment. Now, that's actually about what we'd expect given the Pareto principle, which is the 80-20 rule, that 80% of the audience is just listening and 20% is contributing. But what's really interesting is that the two revolutions that I mentioned, the mobile revolution and the social networking revolution, are starting to have an effect on that. That when you hand someone a smartphone, they're more likely to contribute to the conversation online. So as you watch the spread of smartphones throughout the population, think about what it will mean when everyone who has something to share about an experience at a certain hospital or with a certain clinician or with a certain drug? What if they had the means to share it? And the other really interesting trend that we're watching is something we call the diagnosis difference, that it also makes a difference when someone has a chronic condition. They are more likely to contribute to these online review sites that review hospitals and clinicians and drugs. And so again, as more people with chronic conditions go online, what's going to happen? Is there going to be an opportunity for more sharing? And will that principle of more people listening than contributing change?
Well, Susanna, certainly one of the most accessible connecting tools that plays into all of this in the world of mobile phone technology is texting. And a recent guest on our show, BJ Fogg from Stanford, had made the observation that texting far exceeds any other platform in terms of eliciting an instant response. Tell us about your research on the growth of texting and its emerging power as a tool that facilitates patient engagement with each other as well as with their providers.
Well, first, 88% of American adults have a cell phone, and that's also pretty high among teenagers. And I bring up teenagers, of course, because they are the champions at texting. And we've even seen in our research, just looking at teens, there's a wonderful quote by a teen who said, "Email is for old people." That this teenager literally only uses email if they are communicating
with
a teacher or a parent. And that really, if you want to reach a teenager, then you need to send them a text. Some research was done in the Netherlands that showed that when someone receives a text, they're likely to open it within the first 2 or 3 minutes of receiving it. And I've heard that called the FedEx principle. You know, the idea is that when the mail arrives, maybe you look at it, but when a FedEx arrives, you open it right away. It must be something important. And that's still true of text messages, that as soon as a text arrives, it kind of, you know, your phone buzzes, you're interested, you wonder who it is, you can't resist, and you look at it. There was a study that was done by the Center for Connected Health in text message reminders to people who have had skin cancer. At 7 a.m. every day, the dermatologist would send a text message with the weather report reminding the person to put on sunscreen. And what they found is that those text messages were very likely to be opened. And they gave them a tube of sunscreen that had a cap that sent a message back to the researchers if the cap was opened, which meant that the person was putting on sunscreen. And they increased compliance of putting on sunscreen by, I think, 20%. It's that text message that can reach the person instantly and remind them to put on that sunscreen. You can imagine how that might be used in other healthcare contexts.
So, Susanna, you had the opportunity to attend Wesleyan University, which is right here in our backyard, and you talk about it in your talks of the encounter that you had with a freshman geology professor who really altered your way of thinking. He said, to understand the landscape and its history, you have to study all aspects of it, especially if you want to spot trends. In your work at Pew Research Center, you call yourself an internet geologist, as well as a nowist, but a geologist. Now, there are other technologies that are changing the landscape of healthcare, and you've surveyed other trends like the future of robotics in the integrated networks in healthcare. Tell us about other trends you've analyzed in that area that are poised to transform healthcare.
Pew Internet does a series of reports about the future, and we elicit responses from experts all across different fields. And what we do is give them a tension pair where we ask them to think about what the future might hold, where we make a prediction. And one is a positive prediction and one is a negative prediction. And that's where we get some really, really interesting insights. And indeed, we are seeing that people are, in general, quite hopeful about technology, even in healthcare. Healthcare is a sector that frankly has been quite slow to change. but we are now starting to see a recognition that technology can be useful. I guess what I'm really interested in is tapping into the power of networks. Well, I think, you know, there's some fabulous things going on in terms of long-distance care and robotics. I am personally very interested in the daily choices that people make that make the difference in avoiding hospitalization and what people can learn from each other. So I'm just very much interested in the velocity of the social interaction that comes from ubiquitous broadband, ubiquitous mobile, and ubiquitous social networking.
We've been speaking today with Susanna Fox, Associate Director of the Pew Research Center Internet and American Life Project, which studies the social impact of the Internet and the intersection between technology and healthcare. Susanna, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations today.
Thank you.
I'm Mariano Hayer with this Tech Report. It seemed so futuristic back in those early 60s, all the boys wanted one, a Dick Tracy wrist radio.
Here at last, the new Dick Tracy two-way wrist radio that keeps you in constant touch with your buddies.
Mobile communications have exploded since those early days, and along with it, the world of mobile health. At last check, there were some 35,000 mHealth-related apps created for smartphones, with many more to come. So while everyone is using apps to monitor things like physical activity, their heart rate, even their mood, where does all that information go? That's at the heart of the mission at the Dartmouth Institute for Security, Technology, and Society. Dean of the Computer Science Department, Dr. David Coates, says there's a lot of good that can come from personalized health monitoring. But at this institute at Dartmouth, they're really focused on ensuring mHealth privacy and security while collecting all sorts of meaningful data on yourself. His team has launched a bracelet, a wristband with sensors and tiny electrodes that conduct something called bioimpedance, which technically senses that it's on the wrist it's supposed to be on, a front line of security for mobile health apps.
And by measuring that bioimpedance and comparing it with the records from the last time you wore it, we hope that we can recognize it's you again and distinguish you from someone else who might put on the bracelet.
Coates says the Institute is looking at ways to integrate one's own health data into what they're calling a data amulet, which would securely collect and store your data, something Coates and his colleagues fear can't be guaranteed going straight to a mobile phone.
But it would also have wireless radios so that it can talk to your smartphone. It can talk to other devices that might be located elsewhere on your body. And it would have secure hardware. And its main purpose, from our perspective, is to help build a secure, privacy-preserving body area network of sensors. And so that we can make sure that these mHealth applications are providing the high level of security you would expect for sensitive data and protect the privacy of the wearer.
The Dartmouth Institute for Security, Technology, and Society hopes to be able to roll out its bioimpedance wristband and amulet platforms to all sorts of mHealth developers who want to improve remote monitoring of patients without compromising their security at the same time. They're working in conjunction with the National Academy of Sciences. I'm Mariano Hare with this Tech Report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.